Are you troubled by strange noises in the middle of the night?
Do you experience feelings of dread in your basement or attic?
Have you or any of your family ever seen a...
Sorry, wrong commercial. I'm Megan.
And I'm John.
And we're the Retro Club, where we take movies we grew up with and break them down.
We discuss our likes and dislikes, the characters, soundtrack, and how the movies have aged over time.
Find us every Wednesday wherever you stream your favorite podcast.
And join in on the conversation on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Slasher at the Retro Club Pod.
Be sure and tell them Large Marge sent you.
You are listening to A Scary State, and this week we're covering Montana. So, Kenzie.
Yes, Lauren.
Let's get scary.
You do it so effortlessly.
Thank you. I've had a long time to practice.
I mean, kind of, so have I.
You have. So there's really no excuse, actually.
I'll get there.
You'll get there one day.
It's almost part of my charm at this point.
Oh, that's what makes you unique.
Yes, and special.
So I went to my cabin in the woods this past weekend.
Oh, yes. How was your cabin in the woods?
Okay. It was really fun. We had a really good time. But Joe and I got there before everyone else at like 4 o'clock, as is typical with this friend group.
No, it's typical with you.
Well, we were able to check in at 4. So we got there at 4. Everyone else got there at like 7. What? Okay. In my defense,
one you said typical with this friend group, and they got there 3 hours after you did.
Yes, they're always late.
So it's not typical for them to be on time. It's typical for you to always be early.
No, we were there on time. They were late.
You're always there, like, really early, though.
We were only there 10 minutes before 4 o'clock. Anywho, so, well, because one of them was like, oh, well, we'll be leaving at 1:30, so we should get there by 4. And then at 4 o'clock, we were like, we're about to, like, get there. And they were like, oh, yeah, we're going to leave at 4.
When we went to go dress shopping for your wedding.
Yes.
And I told you that the place was like 15 minutes away. You picked me up 40 minutes early.
It's a problem. Like, it's a problem.
I know.
I'm just always early. I don't like being late. It really. Anywho. But so we get there. It's great. But as we're like unpacking everything, I'm in the kitchen getting all of our stuff unpacked. And Joe's like running back and forth, bringing the stuff in. And I hear like this chime noise. And I was like, Joe? And he didn't answer. And I was like, I don't know what that was. And then we figured out it was a motion sensor.
Ah.
So then we're downstairs in the basement playing. They had a foosball table. So we're playing, waiting for everyone else to get there. And we hear this noise. And it was a very creepy, creepy noise. It like sounded like kind of like an alarm or something. That's what I sent you. And I was like, there's a really creepy noise. And why it was extra creepy was because, okay, Joe and I had watched a scary movie called The Rental.
See, that was your first mistake.
It was. It's about an Airbnb that is scary. So I made Joe check all of the closets and under all the beds and all the doors.
You know, you'd probably be far less nervous if you didn't watch these movies.
Well, fun fact, we found out 2 of the doors didn't lock. Like, they just did not lock. One was the downstairs basement door, and one was, like, the big, like, opening doors that lead you out to the deck. And I was like, this is creepy. So we're downstairs with the door that's unlocked upstairs. So we hear this noise, and I'm like, someone is in the house. So we walk around and look. We didn't see anything. Mm. So we go back downstairs, we play the game again, and then we hear the noise again. It was from frickin' turning the little foosball table handles. Yeah.
He's so stupid.
Well, that's why I texted you. I was like, never mind, crisis averted. Like, we're fine. And I
and
like,
you did like a frowny face. I was like, you're sad about this?
Yeah, I was embarrassed.
You should be.
And I had texted the group and I had told them, I was like, Joe, and I found a really weird noise. Stay tuned. And then I messaged back. I said, okay, figured it out. No need to worry. And Christine goes, what was the weird noise? I'm worried now. What was it? You can't just say there's nothing to worry about. So I had to explain our embarrassment again. But yeah, that was really fun. We played Beer Olympics.
And you just explained it to all hundreds of thousands of people that listen to us.
It's fine. Then we played Beer Olympics. My team won because we're amazing at beer games. Yeah, it was a really fun weekend.
That's good.
Then we had to come back to reality.
Yes, you did.
But yeah, it was good. Other than the doors not locking and that being super freaky at like 1 a.m.
I spent the weekend at your house without you watching your dog.
Because you're the most amazing person.
I know. That's great. I made a whole bunch of TikToks.
Which oh, good.
You should all go to our TikTok and like them so that, you know, we can go viral or something.
They're really funny.
Famous. I think they're fucking hilarious. But then, like, look at, like, just the people that are friends with us will like it.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm like, okay, but this is really funny.
Obviously, we think it's very entertaining.
I thought it was hilarious. But I started to get used to hearing my voice on recordings because good. I'll have to like replay sections of the video
yep.
in order to make sure things align properly.
Uh-huh.
And then I get annoyed with the video for a second because I've listened to it so many times.
There will be times like when I'm editing our stuff where if there's like a certain annoying section where I have to like keep editing it, it'll play the same part over and over so I can keep listening to it. And after a while, Joe will get annoyed and he'll start repeating it. And I'm like, I'm sorry, I have to do this. But after a while, you kind of like don't even think about the fact that it's your voice anymore.
Yeah.
You just kind of listen to it and you're like, cool. Like, you know, this is what it is.
Pretty much. Yep. Oh, also speaking of social media, if you go onto our Instagram and I believe our Twitter, but the link in our bio is for a Google form that you can kind of sign up for giving a small donation to support this podcast. Mm-hmm. And in return, you will get a sticker and a thank you card. And depending on your donation, it can be personalized or just thank you.
Yeah.
So if that's something you're interested in, you know, feel free to fill that out. If you're not super comfortable with that and you want to just message us personally, that's totally fine. Mm-hmm. You can email us at ascarystatepodcast@gmail.com or any of our social medias as well.
Yeah, we're very excited about it. The stickers look awesome. The cards look awesome. So we're very excited to finally have a little bit of merch. It's not a ton, but we're getting there.
And seriously, buy it. We have 2,000 stickers, so please. Please tell buy a bunch and then give them to your friends who, whether or not they listen to us.
Right.
I don't care. Just
we were just
buy these stickers.
So.
Because we have so many. So.
So also speaking of something scary, it's completely off topic. Remember the thing I told you last week about the zigzag vision I had?
Yes.
Like the other week? I got it again yesterday.
I know.
It's very scary.
That is
scary.
And
I don't know what's happening. And then one of my coworkers was like, well, when's the last time you went to the eye doctor? And I was like, it's been probably 3 or 4 years. And so.
The last time I went to the eye doctor was before I left for college.
No. Oh, jeez. Yeah, mine. Maybe that was mine. Because I got glasses for distance because I was like, yeah, when I'm in class, sometimes I sit in the back of the room, so I need them for distance. I haven't been in a classroom in, what, since we graduated college, so 7 years?
I find myself squinting, and I don't know if it's, like, because I can't see, because squinting doesn't make it any more easy to read.
No, not at all.
So, I don't know. I probably should just get them checked just to see.
Yeah, I kind of really need to go, and Joe's contacts are, like, 15 years old. Like, his, not the contact, actual contact, like, the prescription. Oh, my God. The look of disgust on your face.
I mean, yeah. That would have been really gross. I was like, they only lasted a day.
Oh, my God. Yeah, his are supposed to be either, like, monthly or daily, and he just, like, kind of pushes them past how much they should be used. I'm like, Joseph, we can go to the eye doctor. It's in my insurance. Like, we can do this. We are adults.
Yeah, it's nice being able to just wake up and see.
It is.
I don't have to worry. I can just open my eyes and bam.
I know.
See everything.
I know. It seems so scary to like open your eyes and everything's blurry.
Yeah, that's weird.
I feel really bad for glasses and contact wearers.
I also just find it hilarious that like having eye issues is like a separate, like the glasses aren't covered.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it's like this whole, and it's like, it's not like someone stabbed themselves in the eye.
Right.
Like, it's not there. Like, it's a perfectly valid health condition.
Uh-huh.
It's just because it's not everyone that has to deal with it.
Exactly.
And I'm like, that's stupid.
Just like orthodontal things and dentist things.
Right.
Well, anywho.
Anyway.
You want to tell us about Montana?
I'd love to tell you about Montana. So people have lived in Montana for more than 12,000 years. And to a to appreciate Montana's size, you could fit Delaware, Pennsylvania, New York, Maryland, Virginia, and D.C. all into Montana.
I bet you can't believe why I would include that fact.
So what that means is you could take the states of Delaware and Pennsylvania, New York, Maryland, Virginia, and the city of D.C.
Mm-hmm.
and all put them inside the state of Montana.
See, I didn't need to include that in the notes because I knew you'd be so kind to explain that for everyone.
You know what? Just in case anyone wasn't sure what that meant.
We got you covered.
Oh, eBay. All right. Montana is estimated to have 1,800 grizzly bears, which, fun fact, the roller coaster grizzly bear.
Yeah.
Or the grizzly or whatever it
is. In King's Dominion.
Yeah. That was the last roller coaster I ever went on.
Oh.
Because that was like the last one before all the crap with my head.
That's the one I feel like I almost died on. We will go at night for the Halloween, like the haunt or whatever. And so it's dark back there and it's a wooden coaster.
Sure.
And so you go around and there's no lights.
Right.
But because it's so old, I don't think the brakes work. So there's one turn that you go around and you're supposed to brake. Well, the one we were going on, it sped up.
Oh, good.
So we go flying down the first ramp. Our thing comes up a little bit and I just closed my eyes and I was like, this is how I die. And so I just closed my eyes and the ride ended and I said, okay, so we're done with this one, because that used to be our favorite one because it was dark and so
not
scary.
Not the grizzly, the Rebel EL, which is also a wooden roller coaster.
It is also a wooden roller coaster, but it's not in the woods and creepy.
No, but it does go backwards.
It does, but that one seems to be broken often, so it never goes backwards.
Yeah, it never goes backwards. It hasn't gone backwards since, like, I was too young to want to go on a roller coaster backwards.
Right.
Now I don't want to go on them at all.
I also haven't been to King's Dominion since before COVID.
You know, it sucks because, like, I actually liked roller coasters.
Yeah.
You know, and it was, like, the one height thing I could do because it was so fast.
Yeah, by you're the not, time like, you're at like, your height.
You were up there, and you didn't have, like, it's not like water slides, which I like water slides, but the problem with water slides is that
you have to climb up.
You have to climb up.
And then, it sometimes sways.
There was one time my sister and I went to a water park in Florida, and we were climbing up the stairs. And I felt so bad. We get to this one point where it's like kind of like a mini bridge, but it, like more like a cement landing. Like it's not like a bridge, but I refused to cross it until there was enough space for me to stand on the other side.
Oh no, that's perfectly valid.
But all the people behind me, like the line was not moving because I would not stand in the middle of that bridge.
I mean, I don't blame you. I wouldn't have done that either.
And then by the time we got to a certain part, there was like a bird that flew by. And so I closed my eyes and told my sister she had to lead me to the rest. I couldn't do it. I was freaking out.
Well, yeah, you're as high as birds.
And so it starts off where one of you is backwards. And I said, well, you're going to go backwards. That motherfucking raft spun itself around and I was backwards the whole way.
That's always how it goes.
I was so pissed. I was so mad. But yeah. Anyway, grizzly bears. See? Tangents.
Oh.
People are going to know everything about our life.
Oh, yeah. We know it.
They can weigh anywhere between 396 and 800 pounds. Huh. They are the most aggressive type of bear. They're actually the type of bear that will attack a human, especially if they feel threatened or surprised by the human. I also feel constantly threatened and surprised by humans. So the grizzly bear is also their state mammal.
So it's like this super aggressive, scary thing, but they're like state mammal.
So not sure if nobody realizes but I did. But I see on here you have something about the flag. And it made me think that for our Instagram posts, when I put like the flag and then the map, Oregon, Kansas, and Montana, all their flags are blue and all of them have a yellow, the state name written in yellow.
Interesting.
I was like so confused because I was looking at because I almost messed up the post too.
And of course,
I started
yes.
typing in Montana when it was Kansas. And I was like, that's odd. Like I thought, no, we just did that because Oregon also has its name on it.
Yeah.
Anyway, just something I noticed. Montana is also home to about 8,000 moose.
Or meese, if you will.
Mm-hmm. The Montana flag was the first flag carried by the 1st Montana Infantry that, in 1898, fought Spanish forces. Montana was the first state to elect a woman to Congress. Woo. Hell yeah. Jeanette Rankin... Ooh, my voice cracked. Puberty. Jeanette Rankin was elected in 1916 and reelected in 1940.
Hell yeah.
A snowflake that had a diameter of 15 inches, or 38 centimeters, was observed in Fort Kiev. On January 28th, 1887, it's the largest snowflake ever observed that we know of. Maybe the other ones just weren't reported.
Maybe.
And how do you measure the diameter of a snowflake? They, like, melt as soon as they land anywhere.
Unless it's really, really cold. People have been able to take pictures of snowflakes. I'm sure there's a way to do it.
I suppose. In 1887?
Yeah.
Anyway.
Chlorofluorocarbon.
All right. Dating that the water in... Why didn't you just say carbon dating?
Because it's not carbon dating.
But it has, is it not, is it just, isn't it just the longer version of carbon dating?
No, it's chlorofluorocarbon dating. It's not just carbon dating.
Okay.
It has something to do with water.
Well, what she said. The water at the Giant Springs takes 26 years to travel underground before it returns to the surface. That's kind of cool.
Yeah.
There are 13 T-Rex specimens at the Museum of the Rockies. This is more than anywhere else in the world, meaning that this museum...
What? Meaning that this museum has more evidence of T-Rex than anywhere else.
So what that means is... If you were to go to any other museum, anywhere else in the world that had dinosaur bones, it would not have as many T-Rex specimens as this one. Just in case you weren't sure what that meant. So within the span of 24 hours, the city of Loma had the greatest temperature change. It went from negative 45 degrees Fahrenheit, which is negative 47 degrees Celsius, to 49 degrees Fahrenheit, which is 9 degrees Celsius. That is a change of 103 degrees in 24 hours. That's kind of weird.
Wild.
Yeah. Part of Yellowstone is located in Montana. The park experiences between 1,000 to 3,000 earthquakes annually.
Annually.
Yeah, because it's on the Great Divide.
Wild.
Yeah.
That's a lot of earthquakes.
Yeah. It, like, the volcano that's right over there, if that explodes, which it's supposed to.
Yeah.
Or not explodes.
What's erupts. It
called? Erupts. Yeah. Thank you.
Same thing.
Same thing. We're all fucked.
Oh.
Yeah.
So we'll get that, and then we'll get the big one that's going to hit California, too.
Well, that's an earthquake.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then the volcano, that's...
Would it put ash into the air?
Why would probably. We die? So there's one in Italy, too.
Mount Vesuvius?
No.
No, I think that's wrong.
Not that one. But if that were to erupt, it would, like, the amount of ash, smoke, whatever, would blanket, like, Europe and make it dark for, like, 4 days, which would fuck a whole bunch of shit up. But I was like, oh, that sucks for Europe. Like,
oh, so bad for them.
But then we have this one, so.
Ah, good.
Yeah.
Good. Would we die?
I think so.
Oh!
I don't remember. Like, I watched on Netflix. It had, like, the different type of...
natural disasters?
Yeah. And one of them was volcanoes. And I think it talked about this one, the one in Yellowstone or wherever it is over there. Or Yosemite, wherever it is. I can't remember why they said it was problematic. Oh. We have things to worry about. It is also home to super volcanoes. The deepest known cave in the continental U.S. is the Tears of the Turtle Cave. To get to the bottom, it will take you 5 hours, as it is 1,629 feet down.
Hate it.
I don't like caves.
I don't either.
I've had a bad experience.
I know. We all know.
Good. Just in case. This podcast I listened to, they were talking about how so many people will message them and be like, you guys already talked about this before. And they don't remember.
Right.
And I'm like, I can relate.
Yes.
Because I don't remember the things that I've said.
Oh, yeah. No, I don't either.
In a general conversation, let alone on this podcast. Mm-hmm. Oh, the first capital of Montana, Banach, is now nothing more than a ghost town. Great Falls, Montana, is known for its unusually high amount of UFO sightings. This website,
WestfaliaDigitalNomads.com.
listed a little warning for tourists coming to Montana. They warned that the wild animals are not pets. Don't feed them, take selfies with them, or just be stupid around them. Every year, stupid tourists get attacked. Is that where that guy was attacked by that bear? Remember that video that was, like, viral?
Oh, I don't know. There were two bear attacks. I think I talked about it last time we covered Montana, but there were two bear attacks in the same area, like, 1 year apart. So two bear attacks, which is wild, or, like, in the same week or something. Wild. I don't know. But it was some crazy thing about, like, bear attacks.
You should watch the Netflix, you know how they have those, like, tape confession series?
Yeah.
They have one for the Unabomber.
Oh. Mm. I'm sure they do.
They interviewed his, like, siblings. Ugh. It's interesting. Very interesting. Anyway, the Unabomber, Ted Kaczynski, moved into a little cabin in Lincoln where he started to conduct and plan for his bombing. Evel Knievel was from Montana. Who is that?
The guy who did, like, the motorcycle tricks. Yeah, like Daredevil dude.
Like, it's one of those names I know of, but I have no idea what he's associated with.
Daredevil-y things.
Got it. L. Ron Hubbard, the founder of Scientology, spent part of his childhood in Montana.
And that is Montana.
Is Montana. Not to be confused with Hannah Montana. You gotta wonder how much people from Montana hated that.
Hated Hannah Montana?
Yeah.
Probably quite a bit.
Because they probably heard that joke all the time.
Mm-hmm. I bet.
Could you imagine if your name was Hannah and you were from Montana? Oh, God. Poor thing.
The world would just unravel. All right, so we'll just ignore the little tail flips in the background that might happen a couple times.
Yeah, because he's so cute.
Okay. Tonight, I am talking about Stanley Baker. Not Stanley Baker, the actor born in 1928, who played in Zorro.
I thought your person was Jordan.
I changed it.
Sneaky bitch!
Because I could not find enough about Jordan.
Fair.
So I changed it to Stanley Baker.
All right.
So yeah, not Stanley Baker, the actor born in 1928, but rather Stanley Dean Baker, the hippie Satanist.
Mm, yes, easily confused.
Yes, yes, very confused. Actually, it happened a lot. So picture this. It's 3 p.m. on a Saturday afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
You're just out fishing on the banks of the Yellowstone River in Montana near Gardner when your hook snags on something.
Mm.
Annoyed, you try to figure out what it snagged on and go to get the hook unsnagged. But what you find is that you've hooked a human body.
Shut you. You know, there are some experiences that people have when discovering these things that I'm like, knowing my psyche.
Yeah.
And the fragileness uh-huh. of it. I don't fish in general, and then this would just be added to it the list push it of over things the top of that never I again. Never do again.
Absolutely.
So.
Well, this whole scenario is what happened to a fisherman on July 11th, 1970. Terrified and shocked by what he found, the man flew to the nearest ranch and called the police reporting his discovery.
He flew in a boat?
He got into his car and he flew there.
Mm.
Fast. I knew that would cause some confusion. Deputy Bigelow took the call and responded to Yellowstone National Park. The deputy, along with some other helpers, waded into the water and dragged the body to the shore. So you may think that the body was a victim of drowning, right? Well, the deputy immediately knew that wasn't the case.
Oh.
Why is that? Well, the body was missing its head.
Oh my God!
The deputy immediately called the sheriff, Don Gitone, and David, the coroner. David had no last name.
David, the coroner.
The body that was found was missing a head, like I said. It was identified to be a male and was also clad in a pair of shorts and only shorts. Okay, so a little graphic description coming up. The body had been severed at the shoulders and the legs had been chopped off at the knees. The abdomen and chest were covered in stab wounds, one of those being a large hole right in the middle of the chest. So the coroner did his initial examination and had some things to say. Quote, I never saw anything like it. The poor fellow's been stabbed about 25 times, and I figure he's been in the water about a day. He was a young fellow, probably in his early 20s. There's one other thing. The heart is missing. Remember the hole in the chest? So clearly, this body had the main means of identification removed, the head and the hands. But why mutilate the rest of the body so badly, and why remove the heart? The whole thing occurred around the time of this satanic panic.
Sounds like a heartless killer.
So this all occurred around the time of Satanic Panic, as we've talked about before. So the sheriff's thoughts
with Marilyn Manson, right?
Yeah, with Marilyn Manson.
Yeah.
So the sheriff's thoughts immediately went to this being the work of a cult, as there had been some other murders in the area that had been related to satanic cults. The main case at the time was the murder of Sharon Tate, committed by the Manson family.
Marilyn Manson. To be specific.
For all of you who don't know. Yeah. Also commonly known as the Manson family murders, which had occurred in late July of 1969. The body... Every time. And then this gets stuck in my head for days. I'll be like walking into work. We went to the moon.
I mean, I've had it stuck in my head since it aired on Even Stevens in the early 2000s. So your suffering is far less significant than mine.
We've also had this conversation multiple times before. Every time you sing the song.
Yes, because every single time I sing it, you mention how I sing it every single time. So the conversation is just naturally going to keep repeating itself.
Just a ball rolling every time.
Mm-hmm.
So the body was taken to the morgue in Livingston so that a proper autopsy could be conducted. In the meantime, the police began telling the public about the murder and broadcasting the information to Montana and neighboring states. They also brought up that an unidentified body had been found. They were searching all along the riverbank to try to find any clues, but nothing was found, not even the missing limbs. Soon enough, the results of the autopsy came back. It was determined that the victim had been stabbed 27 times with a blade that had a sharp point that was at least 5 inches in length. The removal of the head and limbs had probably been done with the same blade and had been done crudely, meaning that the person didn't have experience removing limbs. The victim was in his early 20s and had been deceased for 24 hours before he had been found.
You gotta wonder if, like, maybe they removed the limbs in terms of transportation.
We will get to it. We will see.
I'm so smart.
Even with the autopsy, this still left police with very little to go off of. All that was left to do at this point was wait until someone was reported missing, which came sooner than expected. That Monday, a missing persons report came in to the Livingston Sheriff's Office with a person who resembled the description of the torso.
How do you resemble the description of a torso?
So I knew you would ask that. So they figured based on the size of the torso, mm-hmm. how much the person would have weighed and the height that the person would have been based on.
Got it.
All the measurements. Okay. So they knew what the person would look like.
They have just identical torsos. It's amazing.
Crazy. So this was 22-year-old James Michael Schlosser, who had been reported missing over 100 miles away in Roundup.
I thought you were about to say 100 years.
No. Schlosser was described as being 6 feet tall and weighing about 200 pounds, all of which did match the torso found. Mm. This report stated that he had set out alone that previous Friday to drive to Yellowstone Park in his 1969 yellow Opel Kadett sports car with black racing stripes.
Ooh.
But on Monday, when he didn't show up for work, his concerned coworkers called his landlady, who stated that Schlosser, a young social worker, had not returned home yet from his trip. Sheriff Gattoni immediately put out an alert to keep an eye out for the car matching that description, as the car hadn't been found yet. On July 13, 1970, the same day that the missing person report went out, California Highway Patrol received a call about an accident that occurred on a dirt road in Monterey County, California. And I want to say, I know we're in California right now. The main part of this, the murder, was found in Montana.
True.
So there's Montana. Okay, a businessman from Detroit on vacation had been driving down the road in his pickup truck when a car, traveling pretty fast on the wrong side of the road, collided with him. The pickup truck had suffered a dented bumper, but the other car was totaled. The businessman got out of his car and began approaching the car that hit him. But out of that car, two large men emerged. Both of them what you would consider your typical hippies. They were both young with long hair and beards. The first man had shoulder-length blonde hair, was about 6 feet tall, and had a very powerful build. He was wearing bell-bottoms and a leather waistcoat under an army fatigue jacket. The other man had dark hair and was wearing a green army fatigue jacket paired with cowboy boots. The two men who got out of the car may have seemed intimidating, but they were actually very friendly. The businessman wanted to get right to business. And asked the men for their driver's licenses so they could exchange information. But I guess fitting the whole hippie vibe, neither had one, so the businessman just took the vehicle registration number instead. He also suggested that because their car was totaled, that the three of them drive to the nearest phone so they could contact the police about the incident, because no cell phones.
That's just, how did people function? I just don't get it.
I don't know. Like, oh, we got into an accident. Let's go find a phone to call the police.
Right. And it's also like, okay, like, I'm going to go on a trip. I'll call you when I get there.
Right. If I get there.
If I get, like, now I knew you were home because I have your location.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Like, when I tell my mom or my friends, hey, text me when you get home, and they don't, I check their location. I'm like, okay, they got home.
Right.
Because I truly mean it. When I say text me when you get home, legit text me when you get home.
Right. It's also funny because I always think to myself when you say that to me, but you have my location.
Yeah, I do.
So, but I still text you.
I know, and I appreciate it. Thank you. Mm-hmm. So he suggests that they all drive to the nearest phone so they could contact the police. The two men agreed and got into the businessman's truck. The nearest phone was located at a service station in the town of Lucia. They finally arrive at the station, and as the hippies were getting out of the car, they took off and booked it into the nearby woods.
Damn.
Now the businessman called the cops and explained the whole situation, telling them about the accident, the men, and providing the vehicle registration number. Little did our businessman know, he had just found the missing car of Schlosser. Since the police had been on the lookout for this car, they knew they had it. They were then told to be on the lookout for the two long-haired hippie men who had been driving it, two men who were now connected to an unsolved homicide. Patrolman Randy Newton was out cruising and patrolling the highway when this alert went out, to be on the lookout for the two men matching the descriptions of the man who ran away. He turned onto a nearby dirt road. Knowing the area well, he knew that the two men couldn't have gotten far. Well, just 2 miles outside of Lucia, Patrolman Newton spotted two men trying to hitchhike.
Watch it actually be Lucia.
Yeah, and the people are going to be like, you're so stupid. Deciding that they matched the description, mainly the long hair, the patrolman stopped the two men and started questioning them. They said that they had no IDs, but did confirm that they had been involved in that accident that had involved the Opel Kadett. Newton immediately arrested the men and radioed for backup. Once his backup arrived, the two men were handcuffed and read their rights. This is when the blonde man identified himself as Stanley Baker, 23, and the man with him was Harry Stroop, 20. Baker went on to tell the police that they were both originally from Sheridan, Wyoming, and had been hitchhiking from there since June 5th. The two men were searched, and in their pockets, a truly terrifying discovery was made. Out of Baker's pocket, the patrolman pulled out a small bone.
Hmm.
Noticing that the patrolman looked puzzled, Baker said, quote, "They ain't chicken bones, they're human fingers."
What the fuck?
"I have a problem. I'm a cannibal."
Who just says that?
Mr. Baker. Uh-huh. He went on to say that it was from his most recent victim in Montana. His accomplice, Stroop, also had a finger bone in his pocket. The hippie hitchhiker known as Stanley Baker and his accomplice Harry Stroop were arrested in California for the potential homicide of the man found in Montana.
Stupid.
I know.
Fucking stupid.
The two were taken to the police station in Monterey, but this didn't keep Baker quiet. On the drive over, he continued to talk about his compulsion to eat human flesh. He described how, at the age of 17, he had received electroshock treatment for a nervous disorder, which is what kickstarted his taste for flesh.
Hmm.
Baker was brought to the police station, and the two men were searched more thoroughly. Baker had some troubling possessions on him. A recipe for LSD was found.
That's, like, the most minor thing out of this whole thing. Like, out of everything that could be problematic, having a recipe for acid, like, not that much of an issue compared to what he's also doing.
Right. He also had a paperback book titled The Satanic Bible and a devil worship handbook that had the instructions for how to conduct a black mass. I don't know what that is.
Okay.
And I was too scared to search that, so I did not.
It's so funny to me, the things that make you nervous versus the things that make me nervous.
See, anything with, like, demons and all that stuff terrifies me. Terrifies me.
Well, I mean, that's a fair fear. I, too, would be nervous by that. But I wouldn't think that anything would happen to me if I looked up something.
But see, it could, though.
No.
There are things that... no. There are things that could be cursed.
Yes, I agree. I forgot to tell everybody about the number that called me!
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God. Phone's over there.
Oh, my God.
There was a phone number that called me. I did not answer, but it was our area code, and then 666, and then, I don't know, four other numbers.
Did they ever leave a message?
No.
I wouldn't have answered either.
Yeah. I mean, I don't answer it anyway if I don't have the number.
Same, yeah, I don't do that either, but I extra wouldn't answer that
one. And I know that I'm like, okay, if it's someone that I should talk to, they'll leave a message and I'll call them back.
Right.
If it's usually some sort of automated whatever or like a spam call, like, they never leave a message.
Right.
And that's the phone call I got. And so I think it might be Albert.
Oh, trying to communicate with you.
Maybe. I mean, I would hope that, you know, just because it's 666 doesn't mean...
Maybe that's just, like, the dead line.
Yeah.
Dead area code, even though maybe it's like, area code.
Because, I mean, but you could have angel numbers, which would be a little bit more positive.
Yeah.
Ooh.
I feel like an angel number of 666 is not an angel number.
Technically, the devil was an angel.
Ah.
That's why all angel numbers are in threes. 444, 111, 333, 888.
Not all angel numbers. It can be any number you see.
My phone number. Wow.
It can be any number you see, too, though.
Yeah, 1 through 9. It has to be 3 consecutive numbers.
No, it
numbers.
Doesn't.
Yeah.
No. You can look up angel numbers.
Like, I know you can look up angel numbers.
Yeah, so it can be like 343.
I don't think so.
Yeah, it can. Look up, like, angel number meaning of, like, 1, 2, 3, 4. They all have different meaning.
All angel numbers are consecutive, Lauren.
Because an angel number is just a number you see constantly. And it's like the angel's trying to give you a sign for what you need to see at that time if you keep seeing a certain number.
Well, because I always saw it like, okay, there's this poster on here that has, it's like angel numbers, 111, 222, 333.
Not necessarily. I mean, you can see what angel number, like, 343 means. Because if it's a number you keep seeing, it's trying to, like, the angels are trying to tell you something.
Okay, but in my defense, typically, based on all the things that I'm seeing here, are...
If you're going with your typical angel numbers, then yes.
Right.
But if you're seeing a number constantly repeating, you look it up, and it tells you what the angel's trying to tell you because you keep seeing the same number.
Mm.
Like, for me, it's 1343.
Isn't that your phone number?
Mm-hmm. So maybe that's
why we start giving out our numbers.
I know, right? All right.
Anyway, sorry.
Let's get back to this. Okay. So Baker was obviously questioned for his claims and statements and the crime and all of that. This was done by Detective Dempsey Biley. Baker started into a story. He and Stroop had been hitchhiking, but around Big Timber, which is just a few miles from Livingston, they had split up. This was at the point where Baker had gotten a ride from a man named James Schlosser. Schlosser. Why can't I? Schlosser.
Sounds like there's a CH next to an S.
There is.
Yeah, I hate those.
Schlosser. From a man named James Schlosser. Baker had asked... I'm going to call him James.
Okay.
Okay. Because I'm going to keep messing up his name and I say it a lot.
Okay.
Baker asked James where he was heading, and James replied that he was going to Yellowstone Park for the weekend. Baker asked to go along, and James agreed. At some point, the two stopped for the night to rest, I believe at a camp in Yellowstone, but they were turned away, so they drove up to Yellowstone River near Gardner and set up camp along the river for the night. But in the middle of the night, Baker woke and snuck his way over to the sleeping James and shot him twice in the head with his .22 pistol. He then got to work and cut up the body into 6 parts, so the limbs, the head, and the torso. Detective Biley then asked what had happened to James's heart, to which Baker replied, "I ate it raw."
Oh, that's disgusting.
More gross things. When asked why he had cut off the fingers, Baker replied that he just wanted something to chew on.
Oh!
I know, it's so gross.
What the fuck?
Once the deed was done, he dumped James's body into the river along with his gun, took the keys, and left in the Oakville Cadet. He circled back around to where he had originally started and picked up Stroop. During the questioning, he mentioned a few times that Stroop had not been involved in the murder and hadn't been there at the time of the murder.
Mm.
He said that, after picking up Stroop, the two drove to Yellowstone Park to camp for the night, but were turned away because the campgrounds were full, so sounds similar to the other story.
Right.
The guard at the park would later say that he had turned away 3 people in James's car, leading to speculation that James was still alive and that both Stroop and Baker had been with him.
Hmm.
Baker described where he and James had camped and where the murder had taken place. Officers were sent to this location and were told to search it. They did, and they found evidence that a murder had indeed taken place here. There was dried blood and a blood-stained hunting knife found nearby. There were also human bone fragments, teeth, skin, and a severed human ear.
Ew.
So here is where I just want to add something in. So Claire Bays was a neighbor of James. In an article written on the 45th year anniversary, Bays was interviewed and stated, quote, "The toughest thing about murder stories is that the victim is written out in the first few paragraphs."
Mm.
So I wanted to go ahead and describe him a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
So she said, quote, "James Schlosser deserves more than a few kind words. He was a big, quiet, doughy kid with a quiet demeanor and thick eyeglasses. He was the kind of son who would call his dad on a Friday afternoon to say, 'Don't worry, I'm going fishing.'" She went on to describe how he helped at his family's deli and just seemed like a sweet guy. He picked up a hitchhiker, you know?
Yeah.
So he just seemed like a very good guy. And so I wanted to touch on that because she is right. You do kind of talk about the victims quickly, which is why I like when we include them.
You know, it's interesting because of all TV shows, you know, me and my Criminal Minds, it was, you know, it was like this, like, kind of not hot-headed, but like really arrogant FBI agent who was all about like the glory and, mm-hmm. and things like that. And she had done a press conference without like letting them know. And, you know, the guy who plays Hochner like called her on her shit, like, "You just want this attention." And he started listing these names. And she was like, "I don't know who that is." He's like, "No, of course not. But they're the names of the victims."
Mm.
Like, you always remember the killer because it's people like you that are glorifying them, you know? And so you remember all the names of, you know, these famous serial killers and things like that. But hardly ever do you remember the actual names of the victims.
Yeah.
Which I thought was a very good point for a fictional TV show.
Oh, absolutely.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So. That's why I wanted to include it a little bit.
Yeah.
But so, continuing on, according to a statement a while back, while in his home state of Wyoming, Baker had been approached and subsequently recruited by a satanic cult from a college campus nearby.
Hmm.
This is when Baker swore his allegiance to the Grand Chignon, or head devil, the cult master. So, Grand Chignon, which I saw multiple times, different spellings, so that's just how I'm going to call it.
Okay.
Was a part of the 4PI, P-I, sadly not P-I-E, movement, a homicidal group. So let me delve into this group for a moment because it was fascinating.
I was going to say.
So
14159.
Yeah. So I got this information from the book Cannibal Serial Killer: Profiles of Depraved Flesh-Eating Murderers, written by Christopher Barry D. and Victoria Redstall. Okay, so we have L. Ron Hubbard, who founded the Church of Scientology,
mm-hmm.
a British breakaway group formed known as the Process Church of the Final Judgment. This group contains cells. Some of these cells were known as the 4PI, the Circle Order, and the Children. So 3 different cells. Those cells all paid homage to the Grand Master, also known as the Grand Chignon. So this part is what the book I mentioned says. Strictly going off of what the book says, I have no knowledge other than what the book says, so don't get mad at me. So trigger warning for animal stuff. So apparently, the 4PI cell had a fetish for German shepherds and Dobermans. They would perform sexual acts with the dogs before sacrificing them. Yeah. And then left turn here. The 4PI also like to kidnap, rape, and sacrifice hitchhikers.
You know, it's interesting that they say 4PI because 4 has nothing to do with pi.
4.15159.
3.14.
Oh. 3.1415. Because Pi Day is celebrated on March 14th.
Yes.
I did know that. All right, so a journalist named Ed Sanders actually encountered the satanic cult. He said their main thing was to lure young members from college campuses throughout the western half of the U.S. The group originally said it had 55 members, a large majority of those members being men and women in their early 20s. The group's leader was said to be a wealthy middle-aged businessman. He used his powers to force or compel the younger cult members to act as slaves and murder random targets all in his command.
Hmm.
Quote, the central object of the cult was to promote the total worship of evil. So apparently during this time, the cult or 4PI movement was known to hold their meetings in the Santa Cruz Mountains near where the original hit and run had occurred. Their sacrifices would usually end with the victim having their heart removed, which the cult would then share among themselves.
Oh my God.
Sound familiar?
Yes.
By 1979, the cult had spread across the country with evidence of over 1,000 members.
Jesus.
Son of Sam, David Berkowitz, had a fascination with German shepherds and Dobermann, and at one time professed membership to the 4PI cult.
Isn't there like a whole thing that's why he did all the things that he did was
the dog?
Was like with, and it, but it was like because of this cult that he was a part of or whatever?
Maybe.
There's something on Netflix.
Charles Manson and his family.
Not to be confused with Marilyn.
Correct. I said correctly. Wow. And his family talked about having had contact with the 4PI movement before the Sharon Tate murder. It is said that some of his family even called him Grand Chignon. So Baker went on to say that he had committed other murders, all on behalf of the cult. He also talked about the human sacrifices that the group performed in the Santa Ana Mountains just south of LA.
Santa Ana.
While being an open book and talking about murders and sacrifices, Baker confessed to another crime he had participated in, the murder of Robert Salem. Salem was a 40-year-old well-known lighting designer in San Francisco. The San Francisco Chronicles explained that there were trails of blood throughout an expensively decorated hippie-style pad.
Ooh.
On April 19, 1970, friends of Salem, a man described as having long hair and an interest in gurus and health food, broke into his home after they hadn't heard from him or seen him in several days. They found him dead on his couch. Another graphic description. He had been stabbed what seemed like 7 times with a very sharp knife. It looked like the killer had attempted to remove Salem's head, but when that became too difficult, the killer resorted to removing his ear instead. That ear had never been found. Satan Save Zodiac and a weird cross-like design were found written on the wall in Salem's blood. Gus Corris, homicide inspector, immediately began to think that maybe this could be the work of the Zodiac killer, a killer who had terrorized the Bay Area in 1968, so not long ago when this crime occurred. Mm-hmm. At one point, the Chronicle had run a story about the murder of Robert Salem, where they called this crime the Satan murder. It was also around this time that police investigators went on record saying they didn't believe that it was the work of the Zodiac. Inspector Corris said, quote, probably the person we are after wanted us to think it was the Zodiac. It was later determined that the weird cross-like design that had been on the wall was not the Zodiac signature sign, but rather an Egyptian ankh. Mm-hmm. This ankh was also found drawn on Salem's stomach. But it wasn't believed to be the Zodiac or a copycat. The Grand Chignon had ordered this murder. And all of these crimes were occurring around the time, like I said, the Manson crimes were popular. So the group was using Salem's blood to write Zodiac and Satan Saves, all done to hopefully add to the whole satanic panic that was going on.
Right.
So obviously, he was asked about this murder, Baker, and he said, quote, I respectfully refuse to answer on the grounds that it might incriminate me.
Hmm.
Baker also went on to reveal his supposed cult tattoos. So the two were then taken in front of a judge in California and were sent back to Montana on July 20th, where the crime had occurred. And on July 27th, they went in front of District Attorney Jack Shamstrom. He remembers Baker as, quote, a very proud, intelligent individual who could make a good impression if you didn't know his background. And what they said, I read too, was that Baker, up until this point, had never been arrested for a crime. He didn't even have any driving tickets. Like,
interesting.
He was just a clean dude.
Huh. At least he hadn't been caught.
That's true. The prosecution was unable to determine any motive for Baker's crimes apart from the apparent lust for human flesh. Brian Mariner, author of Cannibalism, The Last Taboo, wrote, quote, but as we have seen from an examination of man-eating tribes in New Guinea and elsewhere, the eating of a slain foe symbolizes total conquest and total contempt for the victim who is digested and then excreted. So it is believed that maybe the motive of the murder was envy. Baker saw this guy who had everything and was someone who had prospered within the system. So there's this guy, great guy, yeah. Has a great job, great car, all this stuff. Baker has none of that.
Yeah.
While the trial was going on, Stroop remained silent. But Baker was the exact opposite. He claimed many things during He claimed many things during his trial, one of them being that he was Jesus. He spoke about how he had been able to mind control Jimi Hendrix into taking an overdose, all while he was being held in a Montana prison cell.
What the fuck?
He also said that during the time of the murder, he had been under the influence of LSD.
He did have that recipe.
Right. So. There had been a thunderstorm in the mountains that night, and Baker had a vision that he was talking with the devil. That conversation and the LSD were the factors that led him to murdering someone. He also said that there were multiple times when he thought about killing Stroop, but, quote, true friends are hard to find.
Glad he has a moral somewhere.
Right. So, of course, he recounted the whole Schlosser murder, spoke about his satanic cult connections, and spoke about his cannibalism. Evaluation had been done on the bones that had been in Baker's pocket, and the results were read during the trial. It was confirmed that those bones were from a right index finger of a human. The Livingston jury assigned to the case took only 37 hours to deliberate. Stroop was ultimately convicted of manslaughter and was sentenced to 10 years. Baker, who was the one who had actually admitted to the murder, was convicted of first-degree murder and was given a life sentence plus 10 days. The plus 10 days were added by the judge after Baker cursed at him, telling him to go bleep himself. It wouldn't tell me what the word was, but I think we can all assume.
Yeah.
Both men were to serve their sentence at Park County Jail. On August 4th, Judge Shamstrom approved a motion that requested that Baker be sent to Warm Springs State Hospital to undergo a psychiatric evaluation. He was found competent enough to be sentenced to life in prison. But it was funny because the judge was talking about it and he was like, you know, Baker starts like cussing at him and all this. And he's like, what are you going to do? I already have a life sentence. So the judge was like, all right, fine. Plus 10 days.
Love it.
So I was like, that's amazing. But being in prison didn't stop the cult obedience, as it was reported that while in prison, Baker continued to do tasks on behalf of the cult. He would actively recruit other inmates to join his satanic coven, and during full moons, he would go wild, even howling at the moon. He wasn't a model inmate either, threatening guards from time to time and even having different homemade weapons taken from him on 11 separate occasions.
Jesus.
But this didn't hinder anything, and he ended up being allowed to teach transactional analysis to other inmates.
What?
Transactional analysis. So this is a form of therapy where you and your therapist talk about what you want to achieve in your life. You set out goals in order to accomplish that. So he's Sounds helping other inmates with this.
Healthy.
Yeah. Yeah. So I guess that's good. Ultimately, Harry Stroop served 2 years of his 10-year term before being released from prison in 1979. He didn't remain out of prison for long, though. He was in and out for varying amounts of time for a number of different drug charges. In May of 2018, Stroop, at the age of 69, was incarcerated again for being in possession of, quote, dangerous drugs. He had planned to appeal the conviction, but in 2019, the Montana Supreme Court dismissed the appeal after they learned that he had died. Yep. Baker somehow was able to be paroled, which means released.
What the fuck?
After only 16 years, in 1985, to his home state of Wyoming. But his exact whereabouts were unknown at the time. So the parole board allowed his release after it was determined that he was rehabilitated enough to be released. A murderer, a man who killed and chopped up and ate another man, was released back into the public. But in 2009, a story came out about Baker in the St. Paul Pioneer Press newspaper by Ruben Rosario. It mentioned that at the time of his release, in 1985, Baker had been working at a sporting goods store and was actually a top salesman. A tabloid-type TV show had found Baker and had interviewed him, which brought his past back up, and he had been fired from that job after the show was released. All this was, like, back in the 90s.
Yeah.
At some point, Baker later confessed that his crimes hadn't been motivated by that blood-drinking cult he had been a part of or any involvement with Satanism, but rather was just a result of his drug use.
I mean, yeah.
I don't know. He died on July 22nd, 1994, of liver damage. Liver cancer. So, yeah, that's Stanley Baker and Harry Stroop.
Wow.
Yeah. Like I was telling you when I first did my notes, I, like, got to the part where they found the fingers in, like, the first 10 bullets, and I was like, this is going to be a really short episode.
Okay, so it's funny you say that because my story also, like, gets to kind of, like, not the climax, but, like, the
the
big resolution
part. Right.
Very quickly, and I'm like, oh, fuck.
I know.
Am I going to have to find something else?
I thought the same thing. I was like, am I just going to cover, like, little murders that happened in Montana?
Yeah, right?
And then I found the whole story and I found everything else. I was like, ooh, okay, this is big. But yeah, it was kind of hard to find something that occurred just in Montana. So sorry we, like, skipped over to California for a little bit.
It's okay. I stay in Montana.
Oh, good. All right, Mackenzie, what are you telling us?
I'm gonna get myself comfy. So I am sharing the story of Miranda Fenner. So trigger warning to kind of blanket the whole story, really. Mm-hmm. This story does discuss topics of drug addiction and sexual assault, so please be advised and do what's best for you. Miranda Fenner was born on December 26th, 1979, to Mike and Sherry Fenner in Sacramento, California. Oh, my God.
Oh,
look at that.
California.
Where she lived along with her younger brother, Tim, until 1990 when the family moved to Laurel, Montana. Miranda's mom was concerned about the high crime rate and wanted them to be closer to family. Laurel is just over the border of Montana when traveling on US 310 from Wyoming. At the time, Laurel was a small town with a population of just over 7,000. Miranda was always one to speak her mind and hold her friends accountable for doing the right thing. Her parents described her as enthusiastic and outspoken. She was kind and caring to everyone she knew. She loved to write and was an artist, but she wanted to go into a career working with children. Over the summer, Miranda had gotten into a car accident and broke her neck. She was in a neck brace and homebound for most of the summer, so she was really looking forward to her new job at a movie rental store. Miranda would typically be the one to close the movie rental store. Mm-hmm. She had gone to work like she did any other night. She called her mom around 8 p.m. like she did most nights and told her that she'd be hanging out with some friends after work. Around 8:30 p.m. on November 15, 1998, police received a phone call from a man claiming he saw that what looked to be a body lying in front of the video store. The man had stopped and told police that it looked like a female had been shot in the neck. Officer Wells, Guy, Pitts, and Hanton arrived on the scene where they saw three people at the front of the store and a woman seated just outside the entrance. The woman was covered in blood, and the officers began attending to the victim and called for an ambulance. Paramedics took 18-year-old Miranda Fenner to St. Vincent Hospital in Billings, Montana. She was immediately taken to the ER to attend to her injuries. Miranda's brother had decided to ride his bike to the store to rent a movie during his sister's shift, but when he saw the police cars on arrival, he immediately turned back to tell his parents. When Tim and his dad arrived at the store, officers told them that Miranda had been airlifted to the hospital. Miranda's mom received a phone call from Miranda's grandmother just after 8:30 p.m. Miranda's grandparents owned the motel across the street from the movie rental store and told Sherry what they had seen outside the store.
And so she's alive at this point.
Yes.
Okay.
They knew Miranda had been hurt badly and did not know why, and Sherry immediately left work to meet her husband and son at the hospital. She thought that, like, she fell or something and, like, re-injured her neck.
Oh, geez.
The family beat the helicopter to the hospital and were
not good.
Right? And were led to a waiting room. Others began to arrive to support Miranda. When the
What took the helicopter so long? That's what I'm thinking, because they did all the phone calls and then got there, and the helicopter still hadn't gotten there. If they had just gotten into the ambulance, they would have been there in time.
Right. Well, and technically, no one called her parents. Like, it just happened to be that her brother...
Well, the son, but he, like, rode there, rode all the way back home, drove over there, had...
The house isn't that far.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. That's, it's, like, a couple blocks.
Well, still.
Yeah, it's really close by. But, yes, it's still crazy that...
Right.
So others began to arrive to support Miranda, and when the doctors finally came out to speak to the family, they told them that she had died from complications with her injuries that she had received.
Oh, no.
And it was also at that time that the police had told the family that she had been murdered.
They you know what no I idea. Think is so scary is, like, you think when the paramedics arrive or you get to the hospital, like, you're safe. Mm-hmm. Like, you're good, you're safe, it's going to take some recovery, but you're going to make it.
Yeah.
But you don't always make it, and that's what's so scary.
Yeah. I mean, in all fairness, I'll get into, like, her injuries, and, I mean— It was amazing she lasted as long as she did. So, of course, police immediately secured the scene, and they noticed that the back door was slightly open and that there was a blood trail leading from the back of the store to the front of the store.
Ew.
It was most likely from Miranda when she had crawled to the front to the front of the store and outside.
Oh.
Yeah. That's what I said, too. The back of the store was in disarray, and the police processed the scene for fingerprints, took crime scene photos, and collected several items to send to the crime lab from the video store. They collected the statements from the three people who were with Miranda when the police had arrived. They were just, you know, there.
Yeah.
They had noticed her from the road and stopped to help. One of them had gone inside to call for help, but that was the only time someone entered the store.
Okay.
And as you can well imagine, it's a video rental store, so... fingerprints were
everywhere. Impossible.
Yeah. So they really didn't have much physical evidence to go on at all. So another trigger warning, the next few minutes, moments, whatever, I'm going to be explaining Miranda's injuries, and it may be a little graphic for some listeners.
It's been a graphic episode.
Yeah. See, we're just wavelength, man. Miranda had been stabbed and slashed in her throat. When police had arrived, they couldn't tell where Miranda had been injured and by what, because there was so much blood it was difficult to see the wounds. She had a defensive wound on her right finger, and the medical examiner classified her death as a homicide. When the initial investigation began, police were optimistic that they would be able to solve the case quickly. They went door to door to see if anyone had heard anything or saw anything. Even with the hundreds of people they had interviewed, eventually the case started to run cold. In 2000, police had pulled a man over a couple towns over from Laurel. The man pulled a gun on them and shot one of the officers.
Oh.
Officer's fine. Well, not fine, but he survived.
Yeah.
The other officer shot the man who was driving, and the driver did not survive. Mm-hmm. there was a rumor that this man was responsible for Miranda's murder, but when police investigated these claims, it was determined that the man wasn't even in Montana at the time.
Oh, okay.
In the following years, Miranda's family, especially her mother Sherry, ensured that Miranda's story stayed in the public's view. She did not want to give up on finding the person who killed her daughter. Billboard signs. I can't do things with
billboard signs.
Like, there's some things I just can't, sounds I can't put next to each other. Like R's and W's.
And SCH's.
That too. But neither could you.
Oh my God, I know. That was a hard name. There were four consonants in a row.
Yeah, no, that's, can't do that.
And I can say it in my head. Like, in my head, I can say it no problem, but then my mouth just can't do it.
Doesn't want to. So one of the, oh my God, this guy, this video that I watched for this, not that it was funny, but he had such a monotone voice.
Oh.
And so some of the things he said, because of the, like, strict monotone voice he had, were kind of funny.
Oh, no.
I wanted to write down something that he had said that was funny, but I can't remember what it was, and I forgot to write it down later on. So, but the positive silver lining of this is that the community really came together, and within 10 days, $25,000 was raised as a reward for anyone with information.
Wow.
A billboard company even donated...
A billboard?
I can't say it.
Say bill.
A billboard
company
donated a billboard that had Miranda's picture on it, and it said, "Turn yourself in."
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Miranda's mom went on the Montel Williams show in 2006. There she shared her daughter's story and offered another reward for any information. Also on the show was a woman who claimed to be a psychic medium.
Ugh.
She said that Sherry's daughter had been attacked by two men. One of them was 19 and the other was 24 years old. Turned out this lady was a con artist because...
Was it, what's her name? What was her name? Sylvia Brown?
Yes.
Ah!
Yes, it
yes!
was.
Yes!
Yes.
So. Wow, isn't that bad?
Yeah.
That I know the name by saying, yeah. Wow. Yeah.
And like, it's, you know, when I heard that part of the video and knowing how it turns out, I'm like, oh my God, it was like not even fucking close.
Yeah.
Like,
no, she's also had something where I think it was her, someone's child was missing or something. And she was like, oh yeah, your child's dead. And then it turned out the child was alive.
Yeah.
Or there was been
like
other,
a lot of.
Like other times where it's like, oh, your child's alive. They're just wet. Like they're going to be fine. And then they're dead.
Yeah.
It's like, don't.
Yeah, no. Anyhooser, in 2012, Miranda's case had officially been given to the Cold Case Squad. In 2013, the lead detectives on the case, Frank Fritz and Shane Bancroft, got some information from a woman who said that she might have some information. Sorry. About someone who may have been responsible for the crime. The woman claimed that her ex-husband had children from a previous marriage, and she had told the police that she believed that his stepson, Zachary O'Neill, was involved in the homicide. She couldn't give specific details, but told them about his odd behavior and his violent tendencies. She also said that her husband at the time told her about how O'Neill was renting a movie on the night of the murder.
Oh.
Police were able to confirm that O'Neill was living in the area at the time of the crime, but when they went to question him, he laid blame on others, mm-hmm. kind of thing. And police determined that there was really nothing else connecting him to the crime.
Was it a Blockbuster?
No, it was like a mom and pop shop.
Oh, actually, I was going to say, how have we not talked about Blockbuster?
Yeah, no, it was, it's just called the movie shop.
Oh.
Yeah.
Original.
Yeah. But when police did interview the owners... They were, like, obviously very distraught over what had happened. There was only, like, four people that worked there. So it's not like it was,
you know,
everyone knew everyone. And the owners actually donated $5,000 to the reward fund.
Oh.
Yeah. So it was really within a few months that they had raised, not even a few months.
Dang.
A few weeks that they had raised that money.
That's awesome.
Yeah. The family was interviewed again in 2014, a couple of years after Miranda's case officially became a cold case. Even after all the time that had passed, they were still optimistic that her killer would be brought to justice. Her mom, Sherry, tells reporters that she has come to terms with not finding out why, but she at least wants to know who. So, in 2016, Zachary O'Neill was hospitalized at a psychiatric hospital in Spokane, Washington. O'Neill had been in and out of jail and prison over the past several years and had issues with drug addiction and was using methamphetamines at the time. During his stay in the hospital, O'Neill confessed to the killing of Miranda Fenner in Laurel, Montana. O'Neill had been making other claims to crimes that turned out to be false, so no one took his confession seriously. And they released him 2 days later. On March 19th, 2017, O'Neill traveled back to Laurel, Montana, and walked into Yellowstone County Detention Facility. He asked to speak with someone about confessing to a crime. Officers Ellis, Skinner, and Jewell interviewed O'Neill, and he again told them that he had murdered Miranda Fenner in November of 1998. He had told officers that he had tried to tell the medical staff at the hospital, but they didn't believe him. O'Neill also admitted to having recently used methamphetamines, and officers reported it did appear that he was coming down off of meth.
Mm-hmm.
The officers told O'Neill that they would be in touch with him the next day, and they took him to the crisis center. On March 21st, 2017, O'Neill met with Detective Fritz and Bancroft, who had taken over the case in 2012 when it was officially given to the Cold Case Department. And detectives noticed that it appeared O'Neill had been crying when they met with him in one of their conference rooms. When they had asked him why he was crying, he told detectives that he had seen Miranda Fenner's picture in the lobby.
Interesting.
Before the detectives continued the interview, they informed O'Neill that he would not be arrested that day, and they advised him of his Miranda rights.
Mm.
The detectives told him that they would need time to corroborate. I knew that was going to be difficult.
Corroborate?
Yeah. Check out the information he was giving them. O'Neill said he understood and wanted to ensure that he would be able to tell his parents before it got out in the media. The detectives told him that there would definitely be time to do that.
And how old's this guy?
I think at this point, he's close to 40.
Okay.
Yeah. He was born in 1980.
Yeah. Okay.
Which means at the time, he would have been pretty much the same age as Miranda.
Okay.
Yeah. Because she was 1979. O'Neill had been living in Spokane for a period of time and had returned to Laurel in May of 1998. At the time, he was living with his stepfather off of West 12th Street. During that time, O'Neill was committing burglaries and theft in order to support his drug addiction.
Mm.
O'Neill would regularly use methamphetamine, marijuana, and crack cocaine. On the night of the murder, he was with his mother and had smoked meth during the day. His mother had sent him to the movie rental store to rent movies.
What you do at the movie rental store, yeah.
O'Neill rented about 4 or 5 movies, one of which included a pornographic movie.
Ah, nice family film.
You know, it's so funny, though, because I'm like, before the internet.
Right. That was your only way.
Like, if I have to buy tampons, I go to self-checkout. If I buy condoms, I go to self-checkout. Like.
Right.
So that I don't have to make eye contact with anybody.
So you just go, this is what I'm interested in.
I would never have the balls to do that.
No.
Anyway, I probably have to be on drugs in order to have the balls to do that.
Or maybe you'd have to have balls to have balls to do that.
Touche. He told detectives that he was pretty sure he used cash when he rented the movies and described the car that he was driving that night. He rented the movies around 5:04 p.m. and reported that it was only him and Miranda in the store at the time. She was wearing glasses and a blue shirt, and there weren't any issues between him and Miranda at this time, nor did anything occur when he was renting the movies. When he returned, his mother discovered the pornographic video and made him return it that night.
Oh.
He told detectives where he parked his car and had decided he was going to rob the place.
Oh, that, mm-hmm. Yeah, just casual.
Yeah.
Casual.
There were other customers at the time, so he waited in the parking lot until the other customers left the store.
Oh, that's so creepy.
Yeah. When O'Neill entered the store, he held a gun to Miranda and told her, quote, give me the money. She gave him the money and put her hands up. O'Neill took the money, but nothing else. He took Miranda to the back room and decided to tape her up, describing to the detectives where he found the tape and where he put it back. He had planned to leave with her tied up in the back, but became worried when he thought that maybe Miranda knew who he was. He told detectives he was thinking, quote, I don't want to get in trouble for this. That's when I decided to do it. He was taping her up, and he said to detectives, quote, that's when I pulled out this knife I had. When he told detectives what happened next, he became very emotional. So it's going to get a little graphic again, so mm-hmm. Just be advised. O'Neill said, quote, I tried to slit her throat, but it was too jagged. I could hear her gurgling in her own blood. As O'Neill was crying, he said to detectives, quote, I can still hear that sound.
Good.
Mm-hmm. O'Neill thought he had heard someone entering the store and ran out the back door. The gun he was carrying with him at the time was a .22 semi-automatic pistol, and he threw the knife out the window of a car when he went hunting with his stepdad near Jordan, Montana. I don't understand why he used the knife when he had a gun.
Right.
But neither here nor there. Detectives asked O'Neill, granted he was high on meth at the time, so.
Okay, yes.
Detectives asked O'Neill to describe in as much detail the way that he had cut Miranda. Detectives were able to corroborate that O'Neill's story from the crime scene photos in the autopsy. He told detectives that he was interviewed shortly after, but didn't care too much at first about what he had done. He said he was now feeling shame and regret, and detectives then asked if O'Neill had committed any other crimes.
Uh-oh.
On September 5th, 1998, about a month before Miranda's murder, O'Neill confessed to raping a news carrier and attempting to kill her. Julia Lelithin? Anyway, Julia. She was a single mom with cancer who fortunately survived her injuries, but was unable to identify her attacker. O'Neill said that he wore a condom and thought he had left it behind after he had run away. He told detectives he was trying to kill her to avoid going to prison.
Why do they do this?
The detectives immediately went to work to confirm all of O'Neill's claims. They contacted the Billings Police Department about the 1998 rape and if there were any unsolved cases taking place in the month of September of that year. The officer confirmed that there was a case and that they had collected DNA evidence but didn't have anything to compare it to at the time. So detectives sent the evidence to their crime lab to be compared with O'Neill's DNA, and it was a match. Next, the detectives contacted witnesses who may be able to corroborate O'Neill's story. O'Neill had told detectives about a childhood friend who knew of what he had done. The detectives talked to this person. They didn't have a name.
Mm-hmm.
It was initials, so I just keep saying person, friend, whatever.
Yeah.
He confirmed that he had known O'Neill since they were 12 and had stayed in touch over the years. The friend described O'Neill as having violent tendencies and could think of a couple of instances where that had occurred. The friend told Fritz and Bancroft that O'Neill had confessed to him about killing Miranda about 2 months prior to his confession to the police. The friend was very upset when he was told the news. He had known Miranda and her family. He told O'Neill that he didn't want to hear any details and even said that he had his suspicions over the years about O'Neill's involvement in the crime.
Mm.
The friend told detectives that O'Neill's stepbrother had been killed in a fire in 2013, and O'Neill wanted justice for his brother. When they convicted the people involved in his brother's death, O'Neill felt justice had been served. His friend had told him that Miranda's family deserved justice and encouraged to turn himself in.
Ooh, that's a good... That's good.
Mm-hmm. This friend was also the person who had driven O'Neill to the sheriff's office in March of 2017. In May of 2017, Detective Fritz and Bancroft went to Spokane, Washington to interview O'Neill again. He'd been arrested there for other crimes.
Okay.
He repeated the same confession from March and also confessed to a third crime. He had raped another woman in Riverfront Park, but did not attempt to hurt her in any other way.
Right. Okay. I feel like that's hurt
right
enough.
Yeah, exactly. And the rape had been reported on September 12th, a week after the first rape on Broadwater Avenue.
Okay.
They again compared the DNA evidence collected when the victim was at the hospital and it was a match to O'Neill's. Or the victim in this case passed away in 2013.
Mm-hmm.
Did not say why, just that she was no longer around.
Mm-hmm.
Also didn't give her name.
Okay.
Police had charged O'Neill with the rape and attempted murder in January of 2019. At the time, he was being held in Spokane, Washington on a burglary charge and was transported to Billings, where he pleaded not guilty to the rape and attempted murder in January. In July of 2019, he changed his plea to guilty, and police also charged him with deliberate homicide. Miranda's family released a statement after the arrest, saying, quote, "We wish to take this opportunity to thank everyone for their kindness and support over the last 20 years. We're relieved that there is an end in sight for the nightmare that's caused so much heartache and pain to everyone who knew and loved Miranda. Unfortunately, nothing will bring Miranda back, and we can only pray that other families may be spared the grief that this type of crime inflicts. We wish to thank the Yellowstone County Sheriff's Office, the Cold Case Unit, and all the agencies and individuals involved in the investigation. Their dedication and time is greatly appreciated. We wish to thank everyone who shared our posters and signs over the years, everyone who didn't give up and continued to search for answers, everyone who provided so much love and support. Please understand that our family is still dealing with the recent developments in Miranda's case, and we respectfully ask for privacy at this time."
That's apparently, a nice little thing.
Yeah. Apparently, they had flyers up everywhere.
Yeah.
O'Neill was given 3 life sentences for the murder of Miranda Fenner and the rape and attempted murder of Julia Lelithin. I could not find anything else that mentioned the second rape
mm-hmm.
that he had confessed to, but my assumption is probably because the victim had passed away.
Yeah,
but probably. I found another great article about Julia and a program that she started where, like, victims and convicts can, like, connect.
The same convict?
That's what I was trying to figure out. It didn't say in the article.
Okay.
You know, she was using what happened to her as like a, you know, I want to help others. But it didn't say specifically if it meant that the victims and their attacker.
Right.
It was hard to.
Huh.
That's what it sounded like.
Yeah.
I don't know. It seemed like a good program in order to like help both the victim
and if it's helping,
and,
you know.
Yeah. So, but that is the case of Miranda Fenner.
Well, that's sad.
Yeah. Sorry.
Two just sad topics.
Yeah.
I was hoping she would have lived.
Yeah.
Obviously.
Yeah.
Well, Montana.
Montana.
There are some pretty sad things in Montana.
Just a couple.
Well, and a happy thing. Donate to us. Order your stickers.
Please.
Very exciting. Go to all of our social media. Mackenzie's worked really hard on TikToks.
Yes.
Do all the social media things.
Again, for the millionth time, if you have any ideas, please DM me because I'm running out. So
send us emails to ascarystatepodcast@gmail.com. Visit our website at...
Wait.
No, yeah.
I don't know. This is why no one goes to our website. Okay, I got it.
Yeah.
www.ascarystatepodcast.squarespace.com. And on there, you can go to our support page. We have one for episode supports, where if you want to donate to a GoFundMe or to a foundation from any of our previous episodes that we've talked about, that's on the episode support page. And then there's the podcast support page, which shows you all the way that you can support this podcast.
Yeah. Rate and review us and all that jazz. Mm-hmm. So stay scary.
Stay safe.